Welcome to the Deep Dive. We often celebrate the presidents whose stories are etched into our national memory, right? The big names.
The iconic ones.
But what about those quiet architects of change? The figures whose impact, maybe less heralded, laid crucial groundwork for the future.
Yeah, the ones who don't always make the highlight reel.
Exactly. Today we're taking a deep dive into the life of Benjamin Harrison, the 23rd president of the United States.
Harrison.
You might mentally slot him into that Gilded Age president category, you know? Perhaps one of those often labeled average leaders of the late 19th century.
Right, that's the common perception. Sort of stuck between the giants.
But what if we told you Harrison was far more than average? A pivotal bridge between two eras, really. A president who, in many ways, pointed directly to the modern American presidency we recognize today.
That average label is, well, it's truly conventional wisdom, isn't it? Often chalked up to the supposed uneventful nature of his term.
Right. Nothing major happened, supposedly.
But, you know, when we actually strip away those assumptions and dig into the sources, a very different picture emerges. A really different picture.
Okay, tell us more.
We uncover an administration brimming with innovative legislation. I mean, groundbreaking antitrust laws, significant shifts in monetary policy, those high protective tariffs.
Big economic stuff.
Huge. And a surprisingly proactive, even you could say aggressive, foreign policy. And we can't forget his passionate fight for civil rights, though ultimately unsuccessful. It's a fascinating contradiction that really demands a closer look, don't you think?
Absolutely. So our mission today is to unpack this paradox for you. We want to go beyond the quick summaries, the textbook lines.
Get into the nitty-gritty.
Exactly. Reveal the specific moments and policies that underscore Harrison's true significance. We'll explore his surprising stances, his deep personal commitments, and, you know, the echoes of his decisions that still resonate in American governance today.
Yeah, how those ripples are still felt.
So get ready to challenge what you thought you knew about the 23rd president. Where do we even begin to peel back the layers on this fascinating figure? His roots, maybe?
I think that's the perfect place to start. His background tells us a lot.
Okay, so to truly understand Benjamin Harrison, we have to start at his roots. And this wasn't just a Harrison, right? He was steeped in American political aristocracy.
Absolutely. Comes from serious lineage.
Born August 20, 1833, North Bend, Ohio. Grandson of the 9th U.S. President, William Henry Harrison.
Do the canoe.
And the great-grandson of Benjamin Harrison V, a Virginia planter, a founding father, signed the Declaration of Independence. Serious stuff.
Definitely a name that carried weight. Expectations, too, I imagine.
For sure. Now, while this lineage certainly carried a certain expectation of public service, maybe distinction, it didn't mean his parents were wealthy. Not at all.
Right. His father, John Scott Harrison, was a congressman. But they were, well, farm owners. Not landed gentry in the same way.
And their family, entirely English ancestry, had been in America since the early colonial period. Deep roots.
Very deep.
Despite their modest resources, his father, John Scott Harrison, the two-term congressman, he made education a top priority, really focused on it, often spent a significant chunk of his farm income on the kids' schooling.
That says something, doesn't it? Investing in education like that back then.
It does. Young Benjamin's early education began in a log cabin school near home, then private tutoring for college prep.
A classic 19th century path.
At just 14 in 1847, Benjamin and his older brother, Irwin, enrolled in Farmers College near Cincinnati, and that's where he met his future wife, Caroline Carey, Lavinia Scott.
Ah, Carey. Her father was a science professor there, a Presbyterian minister, too.
Right. Benjamin later transferred to Miami University in Oxford, Ohio, graduated in 1852. He joined Phi Delta Theta fraternity, a network he definitely leveraged later on.
Those connections mattered.
And he was profoundly influenced by his history and political economy professor, Robert Hamilton Bishop. You can see how these experiences laid the groundwork, right, for his intellect, his commitment to public discourse.
Yeah, those formative years were clearly crucial. They shaped his moral compass, his sense of duty. Like his mother, he became a lifelong Presbyterian during college.
A deep faith.
A very deep faith. It influenced his personal integrity, his whole belief in public service as a moral calling. It wasn't just politics for him. After graduating, he studied law, admitted to the Ohio bar early 1854. Later that year, he used an inheritance, $800, which is pretty decent sum then.
Yeah, like almost $28,000 today.
Right. He used that to move his family to Indianapolis, Indiana. and there he quickly established himself, not just as a prominent attorney, but also as a respected Presbyterian church leader.
Building his reputation.
Exactly. Became a founding member and first president of the University Club, the Phi Delta Theta Alumni Club there. This early dedication to both his profession and his community, it gives us a powerful insight into the kind of character he was building.
Okay, so from the quiet focus of the courtroom, Harrison was soon called to something completely different. The chaos of the battlefield. The Civil War.
A huge turning point for him and the nation.
1862, President Lincoln issues a call for more Union Army recruits. Harrison, now a successful lawyer, a father, he feels this strong personal pull to enlist.
Even though we worried about his family, right? Financially.
Absolutely. Governor Oliver Morton, facing recruitment shortages in Indiana, specifically asks Harrison to help. And Harrison doesn't just, you know, accept some political appointment. He actually recruits an entire regiment himself.
The 70th Indiana.
That's the one. And initially, he declined command, said he lacked military experience.
Humility, maybe. Or just practicality.
Could be. But he was commissioned as a captain in July 62, then colonel by August. This wasn't just a career move, you see. It felt like a deeply personal commitment in a time of just profound national crisis.
He stepped up.
He did. For much of its first 2 years, the 70th Indiana did crucial, if maybe less dramatic, work. Reconnaissance, guarding railroads in Kentucky, Tennessee. Important stuff.
Holding the line.
But then, May 1864, the stakes just dramatically escalate. Harrison and his regiment join General William T. Sherman's Atlanta campaign. Army of the Cumberland.
Straight into the thick of it.
Moving directly to the front lines, where the fighting was fierce, relentless. This is where it'd really be tested, you know.
No more guarding railroads.
No kidding. By January 1864, his leadership had already earned him a promotion. Command of the 1st Brigade, 1st Division, XX Corps.
So he's moving up quickly. Based on merit, it sounds like.
Yeah, seems so. This put him squarely in the crucible of some of the war's most brutal, most strategically important fighting. He commanded the brigade at major engagements. Resaca, New Hope Church, Lost Mountain, Kennesaw Mountain, Marietta, Peachtree Creek, Atlanta.
A real tour of the Western Theater's toughest battles.
He truly rose through the ranks, not just because of his family name, but it seems because of demonstrable bravery and tactical skill under extreme pressure.
He had to prove himself on the ground.
And he quickly earned a reputation, not merely as a strong leader, but as an officer who genuinely cared for his men. There's this memorable anecdote, right? From a really cold winter encampment near Nashville.
Oh, yeah, the coffee story.
That's it. Harrison personally prepared coffee, brought it out to his freezing soldiers at night, reportedly always saying, "Come on, boys," as he led them through the cold.
This rehumanizes him, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It shows us he wasn't just a general giving orders from, you know, way back. He was someone who was in the trenches, literally with his troops, sharing their hardships, looking after their welfare. This glimpse into his personal leadership style. It's a powerful aha.
Yeah.
Moment. It reflects a deep sense of responsibility for those under his command. Suggests that for Harrison, leadership was always about duty and care, not just about personal glory or ambition.
Let's focus on one particularly illustrative moment of that leadership. Mm-hmm. The Battle of Resaca, May 15th, 1864.
Okay.
Harrison's brigade faced Confederate Captain Max Vanden Korpat's artillery battery. Heavily fortified. This wasn't just some small position. It was an 80-yard deep redoubt, protected by infantry and rifle pits, more in main trenches. A tough nut to crack.
Formidable defense.
Harrison, personally leading the 70th Indiana, masses his troops in a ravine opposite. Then he leads a direct assault, right over the artillery parapet, capturing the battery in intense hand-to-hand combat.
Wow. Leading from the front.
It was described as a furious struggle. His unit was exposed to intense gunfire, but they secured those cannons. What this tells us is that Harrison was a hands-on commander, willing to take direct action, significant tactical risks to achieve an objective.
Yeah, that direct, meticulous approach to problem solving, even under fire. You can almost see how that translates later, right?
Mm.
Building the Navy, tackling trusts.
It's like a direct lineage, isn't it? Battlefield to the Oval Office.
It really seems so.
Another pivotal moment, the Battle of Peachtree Creek. July 20, 1864.
Okay, another big one in the Atlanta campaign.
Harrison's brigade, Illinois, Ohio, his own Indiana regiments deployed right in the center of the Union line, tasked with stopping a fierce assault from Confederate forces.
High-pressure situation.
And here's a critical detail, something that really speaks to his ingenuity, his resourcefulness under pressure. Ammunition was running dangerously low.
Oh boy. Nightmare scenario.
So Harrison orders his officers, Captain Scott and others, to cut cartridge boxes from the rebel dead within our lines to resupply his soldiers.
Wow. Talk about thinking on your feet. Grim, but incredibly practical.
Right. In the face of death, just finding a solution.
That detail is absolutely remarkable. Demonstrates incredible resourcefulness under the most extreme pressure imaginable. And, you know, in his report on the battle, Harrison attributed his brigade's very slight losses partly to the enemy firing too high.
Huh. Interesting detail.
It offers a fascinating insight into battlefield dynamics, but also his sharp observation skills. It shows a commander who is not only brave, but also highly adaptable, analytical, even in the chaos of battle. That kind of meticulous observation, that problem solving. It's a thread we'll definitely see woven throughout his later political career.
And he clearly recognized the lasting significance of these places. He later supported creating an Atlanta National Military Park, honoring the history made on those battlefields where he fought.
Connecting the past to the future.
After Atlanta's fall, September 2nd, 1864, General Sherman himself offered high praise. Said Harrison served with foresight, discipline, and a fighting spirit.
High praise indeed from Sherman.
He briefly campaigned for Lincoln's reelection, but soon returned to command. Led his brigade at the decisive Battle of Nashville in December.
Still in the fight.
And for his achievements at Resaca and Peachtree Creek, Lincoln nominated him for Brevet Brigadier General.
Which is like an honorary rank, right, for distinguished service.
Exactly. Recognizes bravery, but doesn't grant permanent higher command. The Senate confirmed it in February 1865. He finally mustered out with the 70th Indiana in June 65, participated in the Grand Review in Washington, D.C. at the war's end, a real hero's send-off.
A significant military career, no doubt. But what's truly intriguing here, despite these memorable achievements, the praise. Harrison apparently held a dim view of war.
Really? After all that?
Yeah. Considered it a dirty business that no decent man would find pleasurable.
Mm-hmm.
That perspective is crucial. Because it deeply informs his later foreign policy decisions.
How so?
Well, in 1888, the year he won the presidency, he declared, "We Americans have no commission from God to police the world."
Wow, that's a surprisingly cautious stance for a decorated Civil War general.
It is, isn't it? Especially one who showed such tactical skill and bravery. It points to a preference for diplomacy, for commercial reciprocity, over just jumping into military intervention. It highlights a deeply thoughtful, rather than, you know, hawkish approach to global affairs. Very interesting contradiction.
Okay, so the war ends. Harrison comes home. What next? Back to law.
Immediately. He wasted no time reestablishing his civilian life, resuming his law practice in Indianapolis. Quickly became known again as one of the state's leading lawyers.
His reputation preceded him, it seems.
And cemented it. In a testament to his standing, he was even elected reporter of the Indiana Supreme Court while still technically serving in the Army.
How does that work?
Well, the position wasn't overtly political. It involved preparing and publishing court opinions, which he then sold to the legal profession, provided a steady income, solidified his place in the legal community.
Smart move. Any big cases?
A few high-profile ones. His successful prosecution, though it was ultimately twice overturned on appeal of Nancy Clem for the Cold Spring murders of 1868, that got him significant public attention.
A sensational case, I bet.
Oh, yeah. He also represented the federal government in Milligan v. Hovey. That was the civil suit following the landmark Supreme Court case, Ex parte Milligan, about wartime civil liberties, federal power. Complex stuff.
So he's building his legal credentials.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Showcased his legal acumen, his ability to navigate really complex issues. But politics was clearly calling, too.
He quickly transitioned fully into politics, right? Joined the Republican Party pretty early on, 1856, shortly after it formed. He'd grown up in a Whig household, so it was a natural shift.
Right. The Whigs were collapsing.
He was elected Indianapolis City Attorney back in 1857, his first taste of public office.
It's in the waters.
Made a run for governor of Indiana in 1872, unsuccessfully. Another run in 1876, where he actually replaced a scandal-plagued nominee. Still didn't win, but he was building his state profile. Becoming a known quantity.
Laying the groundwork. Persistence.
And then the Great Railroad Strike of 1877 hit Indianapolis. He took decisive action. Gathered a citizen militia, mediated an agreement between workers and management, helped prevent wider unrest, showed some real pragmatic leadership skills there.
Bridging divides, keeping order. important qualities.
His path to the U.S. Senate wasn't exactly smooth sailing, though. After Senator Oliver Morton died in 77, Harrison was nominated for the seat, but he couldn't get a legislative majority. Remember, state legislatures elected senators back then.
Ah, the old system. Political maneuvering.
But he kept at it. Led Indiana's delegation at the 1880 Republican National Convention, gained national prominence giving speeches for Garfield, and finally in 1881 he was elected to the U.S. Senate.
Despite rivalry with his old nemesis, Judge Walter Q. Gresham.
Exactly. And here's something interesting. He even declined a cabinet position from the newly elected President Garfield to stay in the Senate. Shows his commitment to the legislative branch, maybe?
Or perhaps seeing the Senate as a better platform for his own ambitions. During his six-year term, 1881 to 87, he chaired important committees, transportation routes, territories.
Getting involved in national issues.
Definitely. He tackled the persistent budget surplus of the era, something we can hardly imagine today, by advocating for generous Civil War veterans' pensions.
Which aligns with his personal history, too.
And his party's stance on spending for internal improvements? It reveals a consistent thread in Harrison's thinking. A deep commitment to fulfilling what he saw as moral obligations, upholding constitutional principles, even when it put him at odds with some within his own party.
And here's where we really start to see those early cracks in the simple conservative label, right? Hints of the modernizer to come. He controversially opposed the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882.
Which his own party overwhelmingly supported.
Because he believed it fundamentally violated existing treaties with China. That was a truly progressive stance for his time, wasn't it? A commitment to international law, human rights, over popular xenophobia.
Remarkable, really. He also unsuccessfully championed federal aid for education, particularly for African Americans in the South. Believed it was crucial for their political and economic equality. These were bold, forward-thinking positions that didn't always win him friends.
No, and unfortunately, partly due to Democratic gerrymandering, that lovely practice of drawing electoral districts to favor one party.
Still relevant today, sadly.
Harrison was narrowly defeated for re-election in 1887, a temporary setback in his political career. He went back to his law practice, but he stayed highly active in state and national politics, clearly not ready to step away from public service entirely. This setback, you could argue, only fueled his ambition for higher office.
Setting the stage for 1888.
Okay, so the stage was set for the 1888 Republican nomination, and the initial favorite, the big name, was James G. Blaine.
Right, the plumed knight.
Yeah.
He'd narrowly lost to Grover Cleveland in 84. Huge figure in the party.
But Blaine repeatedly and pretty emphatically withdrew his name from contention. He even, get this, left the country to avoid being drafted, went to Scotland.
Didn't want a repeat of 84, perhaps? Or maybe playing hard to get?
Could be. But his withdrawal fractured his supporters. They scattered among other candidates like Senator John Sherman of Ohio and Harrison's old rival, Walter Q. Gresham.
Creating an opening. Chaos is a ladder, as they say.
Exactly. And Harrison, in true strategic fashion, marshaled his troops. He worked to prevent Gresham from controlling the Indiana delegation while simultaneously presenting himself as, you know, an attractive alternative, a safe pair of hands, perhaps.
He navigated that fractured party landscape very carefully.
It was a chaotic convention. 17 candidates vying for the nomination. Harrison placed fifth on the first ballot.
Not exactly a front runner initially.
No, but what's fascinating is how he gradually gained support. He became essentially everyone's second choice.
Ah, the compromise candidate. That demonstrates a unique ability to unite disparate factions, doesn't it? Shows his capacity for compromise, his broad appeal, even if it wasn't fiery enthusiasm.
And it turns out, Blaine had privately endorsed Harrison way back in March. Wrote that the one man remaining who, in my judgment, can make the best one is Benjamin Harrison.
Interesting. Behind the scenes maneuvering.
Blaine's eventual public support, after he came back from Scotland, where he'd been staying with Andrew Carnegie, by the way, that helped seal the deal for Harrison, cleared his path.
So Blaine ultimately passed the torch.
Seems like it. And Harrison had the perfect slogan ready. Lacking a strong, established power base, he declared his candidacy, dubbing himself a living and rejuvenated Republican.
Rejuvenated Republicanism. Catchy.
That phrase became his campaign slogan, reflected a fresh, dynamic take on traditional party ideals. Signaled a new chapter, maybe. Vigor, forward momentum.
And the Republican platform for 88 was remarkably clear. Very forward-looking, laid out a specific, ambitious agenda.
What were the key points?
Well, they extolled Lincoln, naturally, condemned the suppression of the ballot by a criminal nullification of the Constitution, a direct shot at Southern voting rights issues.
A major theme for Harrison later.
Absolutely. And most importantly, they advocated fiercely for the American system of protection through high tariffs, explicitly protesting Cleveland's proposals for lowering them. That was the central economic fight.
What tariff battle?
And they pushed for admitting new Western states, anticipated a significant expansion of the Union. The platform actually foreshadowed the admission of 6 new states, all of which joined during Harrison's term. Mm. These highlights show a party and a candidate with a very specific, ambitious agenda that Harrison would then pursue with that characteristic determination.
All that strategic maneuvering paid off. Harrison secured the nomination on the 8th ballot, 544 votes.
Took some work, but he got there.
For his running mate, the party chose Levi P. Morton of New York, a banker, former U.S. minister to France. Formed what many considered a formidable ticket against the Democratic incumbents, Grover Cleveland and Senator Alan G. Thurman. The rematch was officially set.
High stakes. Cleveland versus Harrison, round 2, sort of.
In the campaign against Cleveland, Harrison did something interesting. He took a page from presidential history, revived the traditional front porch campaign.
Staying home in Indianapolis.
Mostly, yeah. A style largely abandoned by his immediate predecessors. He received visiting delegations at his home, made over 90 pronouncements right there from his hometown, effectively bringing the campaign to the people rather than barnstorming the country himself.
Controlled environment, controlled message. Smart, maybe.
Could be. Allowed him to control his message, engage directly with voters who came to him, carefully cultivate his image.
And the Republicans campaigned heavily and pretty successfully on that protective tariff issue, mobilized protectionist voters in crucial industrial states up north.
Where the votes were.
Exactly. The election focused intensely on swing states, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, and Harrison's home state of Indiana. Voter turnout was astonishing, 79.3%.
Wow, people were engaged.
Nearly 11 million votes cast. Reflects intense public interest in the campaign, the significant policy differences. It was truly a high-stakes election, driven largely by those economic concerns.
And here's where we see the unique, sometimes controversial nature of the American electoral system really come into play again. Harrison won the Electoral College, 233 votes to Cleveland's 168.
What?
Despite receiving 90,000 fewer popular votes than Cleveland.
Another Electoral College inversion, like 1876 and much later, 2016, highlights how the system can diverge from the popular vote. Always controversial.
Definitely. And this election wasn't without its own controversies. Allegations of irregular ballot practices emerged, notably the Blocks of Five incident.
Oh, yeah. Tell us about that.
An Indiana newspaper published a letter, supposedly from Harrison's friend and supporter, William Wade Dudley. It seemed to offer bribes to voters in groups of five to ensure Harrison's election in Indiana.
Yikes. Blatant vote-buying allegations. How did Harrison handle it?
He neither defended nor repudiated Dudley. Just stayed silent on it publicly. Though it's telling, perhaps, that he reportedly never spoke to Dudley again after the election. Showcased his careful navigation of potential political scandal without directly addressing it.
Swept it under the rug, maybe? A pragmatic politician's move?
Could be. Anyway, Harrison earned the nickname Centennial President because his inauguration celebrated the 100th anniversary of George Washington's first inauguration.
A rather fitting title, would you say? For a man poised to lead America into a new century, bridging the past and future.
It was certainly grand timing, but his victory, like any hard-fought election, came with political posts and, frankly, some deep resentments within his own party.
The patronage battles begin.
Boss Matthew Quay of Pennsylvania, a powerful Republican operative, was famously rebuffed for a cabinet position despite his support during the convention.
Ouch. Expected a reward.
And he quipped rather bitterly that Harrison would never know how close a number of men were compelled to approach the penitentiary to make him president.
Wow. That highlights the pervasive patronage system, doesn't it? The quid pro quo expectations. A system Harrison often battled, but couldn't entirely escape. You have to wonder how much that internal party friction undermined his potential impact later on.
Good question. So, March 4th, 1889... Benjamin Harrison is sworn in by Chief Justice Melville Fuller. His inaugural speech was notably brief. less than half a length of his grandfather's, which still holds the record for the longest ever.
Getting straight to the point, perhaps?
In his speech, he credited the nation's growth to education and religion, urged continued industrial development, promised to maintain that protective tariff, and he made a pointed remark about corporations that really still resonates today.
What did he say?
If our great corporations would more scrupulously observe their legal obligations and duties, they would have less call to complain of the limitations of their rights or of interference with their operations.
An early warning shot about corporate responsibility. Foreshadowing the Sherman Act, maybe?
Definitely seems like it, a theme that would define his economic policies.
Indeed. And his inaugural address laid out a clear vision, both domestic and foreign, advocated for early statehood for the territories, reaffirmed his commitment to generous pensions for Civil War veterans, got enthusiastic applause for that.
Connecting with that base.
In foreign affairs, he staunchly reaffirmed the Monroe Doctrine, called for rapid modernization of the Navy, promoted international peace through non-interference. These themes directly foreshadowed many of his administration's key initiatives, showed a president hitting the ground running with a well-defined agenda, despite all the political maneuvering that got him there.
And as for White House life itself, Harrison made a rather prophetic observation, didn't he, about the lack of separation between the president's office and private apartments.
Yeah, he noted there was only a door one that is never locked between the president's office and what are not very accurately called his private apartments.
He even suggested there should be a separate executive office building, a vision that eventually came true, just not under him.
Ahead of his time on office design, too.
And here's a fun fact for you. Speaking of modernization, Harrison had electricity installed in the White House for the first time. Edison General Electric Company did the work.
Wow. Bringing the White House into the electric age.
But, and this is great, he and his wife were reportedly so afraid of getting electrocuted that they refused to touch the light switches, often went to sleep with the lights on.
No way. That's hilarious. It's almost charming, isn't it?
Imagine that. The leader of a nation on the cusp of the 20th century, still hesitant about flicking a light switch.
It certainly symbolizes a nation grappling with truly transformative technologies, doesn't it? Where even the most powerful people are still figuring it all out. Shows a certain groundedness, perhaps, or a cautious nature that permeated even their embrace of progress. And it highlights how incredibly quickly technology was advancing and how everyone, even presidents, were adapting to a rapidly changing world.
Okay, so beyond the quirks of White House modernization, Harrison faced the huge task of forming his cabinet, and he notably acted quite independently in picking his team.
Which really rubbed the party bosses the wrong way, right? They expected the usual patronage appointments. Payback time.
Exactly. He even strategically delayed James G. Blaine's presumed nomination as Secretary of State, didn't want Blaine dominating the administration's formation from the get-go. A lesson learned from Garfield's presidency, maybe.
Smart move, asserting his authority.
Yeah.
But yeah, it definitely came at a cost.
Oh, so.
Well, this independent streak, while showing Harrison's resolve, also prematurely compromised his political power within his own party. He alienated pivotal Republican operatives, New York, Pennsylvania, Iowa guys, who felt their loyalty wasn't being rewarded.
Made enemies early.
Pretty much. Senator Shelby Cullom's comment sums it up perfectly. Whenever he did anything for me, it was done so ungraciously that the concession tended to anger rather than please.
Ouch. Not exactly winning friends and influencing people.
It tells us a lot about the political climate, the expectations of party loyalty then. And Harrison struggled to balance his, maybe, reformist ideals with the entrenched realities of political patronage. A tough spot.
And civil service reform was a big issue, wasn't it? Harrison had campaigned as a supporter of the merit system, moving away from the old spoils system.
Yeah, getting rid of to the victor belong the spoils.
But facing a deeply divided Congress and party, he actually did very little to significantly further civil service reform during his term, often delayed decisions on political appointments. The issue became, as one famous cartoon depicted it, a political football.
Kicked around by both sides. The caption was something like, "What can I do when both parties insist on kicking?"
That really highlights the immense pressure presidents faced, right? Balancing reform ideals with political realities, the insatiable demands of party loyalty.
A constant tightrope walk.
And the controversies didn't stop there. While he did appoint reformers like Theodore Roosevelt to the Civil Service Commission.
PR, getting a start.
Other appointments raised eyebrows. Postmaster General John Wanamaker, for instance. He and several friends purchased a large new cottage at Cape May Point for Harrison's wife, Caroline.
It looks a bit fishy, doesn't it? Like a bribe for a cabinet post.
Then he thought so. Appeared improper, Harrison eventually paid $10,000 for it himself, maybe a little late to avoid suspicion.
Damage control.
Then there was James S. Clarkson, an assistant postmaster famous for decapitating a fourth-class postmaster every 3 minutes. A real spoils system guy.
Not exactly a reformer.
Clarkson expected a full cabinet position, didn't get it, and basically sabotaged his own appointment. Openly stated he was simply on detail from the Republican committee and most anxious to get through this task and leave. He eventually resigned. Just underscores the constant patronage battles within the administration.
Constant infighting. Must have been exhausting.
Okay, beyond the political maneuvering, let's talk economics. This was huge in Harrison's presidency. Tariffs. For decades, America had been locked in this fierce debate over tariffs.
Oh yeah, the dominant political issue since before the Civil War, really. Became the absolute defining issue of the 1888 election.
And Republicans, under Harrison, were firmly in the high protective tariff camp. They enacted significant legislation. Under Representative William McKinley, yes, that McKinley and Senator Nelson W. Aldrich, they framed the McKinley tariff.
Which put the highest average rate in American history up to that point. Some rates were intentionally prohibitive, designed to keep foreign goods out entirely.
A massive shift. Doubling down on the idea that the federal government could and should actively engineer national prosperity, basically putting up a keep-out sign for many foreign goods to help American industries.
Exactly. Fundamentally protect American industries by limiting competition. But it also played a huge role in creating that large federal budget surplus and contributed to the image of the billion-dollar Congress.
The first time federal spending hit that level in peacetime.
That's right. So this wasn't just about taxing imports. It fundamentally changed how people saw government's power, moving from a passive referee to an aggressive economic shaper, a real precursor to the interventionist policies we recognize today.
Did they try to soften it at all?
Well, Harrison, at Secretary of State Blaine's urging, tried to add reciprocity provisions. The idea was the president could reduce rates if other countries did the same for American exports.
A bit of carrot and stick?
Sort of. And they removed tariffs on raw sugar, but gave U.S. sugar growers a 2 cent per pound subsidy to compensate. Showcased a nuanced attempt to balance various economic interests, even within that protectionist framework.
But it wasn't just tariffs dominating the economic landscape. His era was also seeing the unprecedented rise of these powerful industrial trusts, monopolies.
The Rockefellers, the Carnegies.
Yeah.
The Gilded Age titans.
And this is where Harrison really steps into the modern presidency, arguably, with an act that would define federal regulation for a century, the Sherman Antitrust Act of 1890.
Truly groundbreaking. Members of both parties were deeply concerned about the growing power of these trusts. They were dominating industries, stifling competition. This was one of the 51st Congress's first big acts.
Sponsored by Senator John Sherman, passed with wide margins in both houses, and Harrison swiftly signed it into law.
This was revolutionary, seriously. The first federal act of its kind. Marked a new, albeit initially cautious, use of federal government power to regulate big business, prevent anti-competitive practices.
Did Harrison believe in it?
Oh, yeah. He approved wholeheartedly of its intent. And his administration did successfully conclude a case against a Tennessee coal company, United States v. Jellicoe Mountain Coal. Initiated several others against trusts during his term.
So actual enforcement, not just symbolic.
Some, yes. This act, though later modified, remains a cornerstone of American economic law today. Represents a critical step toward federal regulation. It shows Harrison's willingness to use federal power to address societal problems that individual states just couldn't handle. Very modern approach, really.
Okay, tariffs, trusts. What about the money itself? The currency question was huge then, too, right?
Oh, one of those volatile economic debates of the 1880s, cut sharply across party lines. Should the nation's money be backed by both gold and silver bimetallism, or just gold, the gold standard?
Why was it so contentious?
Well, it wasn't just abstract economics. Because silver was actually worth less than its legal equivalent in gold, backing currency with both led to a depletion of the nation's gold supply. People hoarded the gold, spent the silver, created significant economic instability.
Gresham's law, basically. Bad money drives out good.
Exactly. And it deeply affected incomes and debts across the country. Hmm. Debtors, farmers, the poor. They generally called for increased silver coinage, an inflationary measure, hoping it would ease their burdens amidst global deflation.
Make it easier to pay off fixed debts.
Right. While creditors, folks in the Northeast, generally favored the stability of the gold standard. It was deeply polarizing. Reflected fundamental class and regional divides. Harrison had to walk a very, very tight rope.
Where did he stand?
He reportedly favored a bimetallist position, personally. And his appointment of a silverite Treasury Secretary, William Windham, certainly encouraged the free silver supporters.
Sending mixed signals.
Maybe trying to find a middle ground. He advocated for free coinage of silver, but crucially, at its market value, not at a fixed ratio to gold. That was a critical distinction.
Trying to compromise.
Ultimately, Senator Sherman, same guy as the Antitrust Act, achieved passage of the Sherman Silver Purchase Act in July 1890. Another attempt at compromise. The Treasury had to buy a certain amount of silver each month.
Did it work? Did it calm things down?
Harrison signed it into law, hoping it would finally end the contentious currency controversy.
Yeah.
But the effect of the bill was actually an increased depletion of the nation's gold supply. It exacerbated the very problem it was meant to solve.
Oh, wow. Unintended consequences.
Big time. So despite Harrison's intentions, this act actually made the gold supply problem worse. It's a powerful lesson, isn't it? Sometimes political compromise, especially on complex economic issues, can inadvertently worsen the very problems it aims to solve. A challenge leaders face even today when trying to balance competing interests. Highlights how complex, how unpredictable economic policy could be.
It really makes you think. When we look at today's debates about government regulation, economic stimulus, the role of the Federal Reserve, you can clearly see the deep historical roots right here in Harrison's era.
Absolutely. These were the fundamental questions shaping America's economic future, and his administration was right at the center of grappling with them, often setting precedents we still deal with.
Okay, let's shift gears slightly, but still related to spending. Veterans' pensions. This was clearly an issue close to Harrison's heart.
Definitely. Tied to his own Civil War service and a huge political constituency for the Republicans, the Grand Army of the Republic, the GAR.
He'd championed generous pensions in Congress, and as president, he saw it enacted. The Dependent and Disability Pension Act of 1890.
What did it do?
Provided pensions to disabled Union veterans, regardless of the cause of their disability, didn't have to be war-related anymore, and importantly, it also helped deplete some of that troublesome federal budget surplus, addressed two issues at once, veteran welfare and managing federal funds.
Killing two birds with one stone, politically speaking. But the spending was massive, wasn't it?
Unprecedented. Pension expenditures reached $135 million under Harrison, equivalent to nearly $4.7 billion today.
That's not just a number. It represents the first major instance of the federal government essentially creating a massive social welfare program. This billion-dollar Congress wasn't just about tariffs. It was also about this burgeoning sense of federal responsibility to its citizens.
But it wasn't without problems.
No. It was prone to the challenges of scale, potential for corruption. The problem got worse under Pension Bureau Commissioner James R. Canner. His expansive interpretation of the laws led to accusations of lavish and illegal handouts, prompted an investigation by the Secretary of the Interior.
So mismanagement and potential fraud.
Exactly. It demonstrates that classic tension. Fulfilling a moral obligation to veterans versus managing the fiscal implications and the potential for corruption that such large-scale programs inevitably present.
How did Harrison handle Tanner?
Well, Harrison privately thought appointing Tanner was a mistake due to his loose management style. He asked Tanner to resign, replaced him with Green B. Raum.
Problem solved.
Not quite. Raum also faced accusations. Accepting loan payments in return for expediting pension cases.
Oh boy, more scandal.
Harrison accepted a dissenting congressional Republican investigation report that exonerated Raum and allowed him to stay in office. It's a complex situation, isn't it? Reveals that constant balancing act between political loyalty, public perception, and the desire for honest governance. A challenge for any president, then and now. #V, visionary or out of touch. Social and environmental policies.
Okay, let's turn to social policy, particularly civil rights. After Republicans regained control of Congress, Harrison, along with some others in the party, made a real effort to pass legislation protecting African Americans' civil rights. This was something he'd long supported, right?
Absolutely. A consistent theme for him. His attorney general, William H.H. Miller, used the Justice Department to order prosecutions for voting rights violations in the South. That was a direct, significant effort by the federal government to enforce the 15th Amendment.
Trying to make the vote real for black men.
But unfortunately, the reality on the ground was harsh. White juries in the South often failed to convict or even indict violators, severely limiting the impact of these federal efforts.
So federal will versus local resistance.
A familiar story, sadly. But that direct action by the Justice Department, even with limited success, was a significant attempt to confront systemic injustice. It makes the resistance and failure to convict even more stark. Harrison's commitment here was truly groundbreaking for his era.
He was passionate about it. He urged Congress to pass legislation that would secure all our people a free exercise of the right of suffrage and every other civil right under the Constitution and laws. And most notably, December 3rd, 1889, he delivered this powerful address to Congress, directly questioning state civil rights records. He passionately declared, and this is worth quoting, "The colored people did not intrude themselves upon us. They were brought here in chains. When and under what conditions is the black man to have a free ballot? When is he, in fact, to have those full civil rights which have so long been his in law? Every constituency in the Union is wronged."
Wow. That's incredibly powerful. Calling out the hypocrisy, the injustice, pushing for federal action when the states clearly failed, holding the nation accountable to its own ideals.
It really was.
And what's truly remarkable here is this sheer breadth and boldness of Harrison's proposals on civil rights, especially given the prevailing racist attitudes at the time, even within his own party sometimes.
What kind of proposals?
He endorsed the Federal Elections Bill of 1890, sponsored by Henry Cabot Lodge and George Frisbie Hoar, specifically aimed at protecting voting rights through federal supervision. But it was defeated in the Senate. Filibustered, actually.
The force bill, opponents called it.
Right. He also supported Senator Henry W. Blair's bill for federal funding to schools, regardless of race, a radical idea for the era. And even backed a constitutional amendment to overturn the Supreme Court's ruling in the civil rights cases of 1883, which had severely limited federal power to protect civil rights and public accommodations.
He was really going for it, trying multiple avenues.
Absolutely. These were the last significant attempts to protect civil rights through federal legislation until the 1930s. Mm. It makes him a true, if ultimately unfulfilled, pioneer in this crucial area. His commitment was undeniable, even in the face of determined congressional resistance.
Okay, shifting from civil rights to environmental policy, another area where Harrison maybe seems surprisingly forward-thinking.
Definitely. In a truly bipartisan effort, Congress enacted and Harrison signed the Land Revision Act of 1891.
What was significant about that?
Crucially, Section 24 was added at Harrison's behest, pushed by his Secretary of the Interior, John Noble. It granted the president the power to set apart and reserve public lands bearing forests as public reservations.
The birth of the national forests, essentially.
Pretty much. This was a pivotal moment for conservation in the United States. An act of foresight that's often overshadowed by, say, Teddy Roosevelt later on.
So Harrison acted on this new power.
Immediately. Within a month of the act's passage, he authorized the first forest reserve right next to Yellowstone National Park in Wyoming. By the end of his term, he had designated an impressive 22 million acres as public forest reservations.
22 million acres. That's huge.
It's an area larger than the state of Maine. He also became the first president to give a prehistoric Indian ruin federal protection Casa Grande in Arizona.
Setting another precedent.
Exactly. This established a precedent for conservation that would become a hallmark of later presidencies. But Harrison truly laid the groundwork, showing a nascent federal concern for natural and historical heritage, a remarkably forward-thinking environmental legacy for a 19th century president.
Harrison's administration also saw some important labor reforms, didn't it?
Yes, several significant steps. An act passed in 1891 prohibited convict labor outside prisons, or in machine production of commodities. Addressed a big concern about fair labor practices and competition.
Taking on prison labor.
And the same year, the first federal legislation governing safety standards and inspection practices in America's coal mines was enacted. A crucial step toward protecting workers in incredibly dangerous industries that had been largely unregulated before then.
Addressing worker safety. What else?
These are quiet but substantial steps towards addressing worker welfare and urban conditions, demonstrating a growing federal role in social justice. For example, in 1892, Congress allocated $20,000, a decent sum, then for the Commissioner of Labor to make a full investigation relative to what is known as the slums of cities, with populations over 200,000.
So the government's starting to study urban poverty.
Exactly. Signaled a recognition that the federal government had a responsibility to understand and maybe begin to address poverty and substandard living conditions in the nation's burgeoning cities.
And there was something about the workday.
Yes. Significantly, in August 1892, an 8-hour workday was introduced for all mechanics and laborers working for the federal government, including public works contractors. Set a really important precedent.
8 hours for federal workers.
And a Railway Safety Appliance Act followed in 1893, aimed to protect railway workers from harm by mandating things like automatic couplers and air brakes. These initiatives were quietly foundational. Showed a president who, despite that conservative label, was willing to use federal power for social progress and worker protection, laying more groundwork for future reforms.
Okay, now we need to address a much darker chapter during Harrison's term, Native American policy, specifically Wounded Knee.
Yes, a truly tragic event. During Harrison's term, the Lakota Sioux, confined to reservations in South Dakota, grew restless, partly due to harsh conditions, broken treaties, and the influence of Avoca,
the Paiute medicine man who encouraged the Ghost Dance movement.
That's right. A spiritual movement preaching renewal, the return of the buffalo, the eventual disappearance of white settlers. It offered hope in desperate times. But many in Washington, in the military, mistakenly viewed this primarily religious movement as a sign of increased resistance, potential uprising.
Fear and misunderstanding.
Leading to a heightened military presence on the reservations, increased tension.
And this misinterpretation tragically culminated in the Wounded Knee Massacre, December 29, 1890.
A horrific event. The U.S. Army's 7th Cavalry Regiment, Custer's old regiment, perpetrated a massacre of over 250 Lakota men, women, and children at the Pine Ridge Reservation near Wounded Knee Creek. It happened following a botched attempt to disarm Bigfoot's band.
Mostly unarmed people killed, buried in mass graves, a terrible stain on American history.
Absolutely horrific. In response, Harrison directed Major General Nelson A. Miles to investigate the incident. He also promptly deployed 300 to 500 U.S. troops to South Dakota, effectively suppressing the Ghost Dance movement through military force. Wounded Knee is widely considered the last major engagement, though massacre is more accurate, of the American Indian Wars, a deeply painful end to that era.
What was Harrison's broader policy towards Native Americans?
His general policy, consistent with many reformers of the time, was to encourage Native American assimilation into white society, break up tribal structures, promote individual land ownership.
The Dawes Act approach.
Exactly. And despite the Wounded Knee Massacre, Harrison publicly believed this assimilation policy was generally successful. However, this approach, embodied in the Dawes Act, while perhaps well-intentioned by some, ultimately proved detrimental to Native Americans. They often ended up selling their allotted individual lands at low prices to white speculators, leading to significant land loss, erosion of tribal culture, and continued poverty. It's a complex and painful chapter, reflecting the prevailing, though often misguided and ultimately destructive, attitudes of the era regarding Native American policy. Assimilation was seen as progress, but it often meant cultural destruction.
Okay, let's shift to Harrison's impact on America's place in the world. His era saw significant technological advances, and here's a fascinating detail. We actually have a recording of his voice.
Really? From 1889?
Yeah, a 30-second recording made on a wax phonograph cylinder by Gianni Bettini. It's the earliest surviving recording of a U.S. president made while he was actually in office.
That's incredible. Hearing a voice from that long ago, a literal voice from the past ushering in the future. Amazing.
Isn't it?
And beyond that remarkable audio snippet, one of Harrison's most significant yet often overlooked achievements was his leadership in marshaling the country's burgeoning industrial and technological capabilities to build a credible modern naval power.
The Steel Navy.
Exactly. When he took office, the U.S. Navy was, well, pretty pathetic. Only two commissioned warships worth mentioning. His inaugural address explicitly called for rapid construction of warships.
He prioritized it from day one.
Absolutely. His Secretary of the Navy, Benjamin F. Tracy, spearheaded this ambitious effort. Within just a year, they got congressional approval for building battleships like the USS Indiana, Texas, Oregon, and the cruiser Columbia.
Serious firepower.
And with the help of companies like Carnegie Corporation providing the steel, by 1898, no fewer than 10 modern warships, steel hulls, greater displacement, advanced armaments, had transformed the U.S. into a legitimate naval power. What's really striking is that 7 of these crucial ships were initiated during Harrison's term.
Wow! That's a huge investment and a rapid transformation.
It was a deliberate strategic effort to project American power globally, protect expanding commercial interests. It truly set the stage for the naval might of the 20th century, a fundamental shift.
When it came to foreign policy itself, Secretary of State James G. Blaine and Harrison, well, they didn't always have the warmest personal relationship, did they?
No. Famously a bit frosty at times. Blaine was a huge figure, expected deference maybe Harrison wasn't willing to give.
But they were remarkably aligned on policy, specifically an aggressive foreign policy promoting commercial reciprocity.
Yes, on the big picture stuff, they were largely in sync, pushing American interests abroad. And here's where Harrison's hands-on approach really came into play. Blaine had frequent medical problems, bouts of illness.
Right, lumbago, other issues.
Which often meant that Harrison himself took a more direct, personal role in conducting foreign policy, drafting diplomatic demands, setting strategy. He wasn't just delegating. He was deeply engaged in global affairs.
A hands-on foreign policy president.
Very much so. In 1891, while on a tour across the U.S., Harrison proclaimed a new epoch of trade. He emphasized that an expanding navy would not only protect American oceanic shipping, but also significantly increase American influence and prestige abroad, directly connecting domestic industrial power to global reach.
A clear statement of America's rising ambition on the world stage.
Definitely. And you saw this vision in action at the first International Conference of American States, which met in Washington in 1889. Harrison set an incredibly aggressive agenda, pushing for customs integration, currency integration across the Americas, Pan-American.
Had it work?
Not entirely. No major diplomatic breakthrough occurred at the conference itself. There was suspicion, particularly from the Argentinian delegation, about U.S. dominance. But it did successfully establish an information center that eventually became the Pan-American Union.
So a starting point for inter-American cooperation.
A crucial first step, fostering solidarity and commercial ties. And following that, Harrison and Blaine pivoted diplomatically and successfully concluded 8 reciprocity treaties with various Latin American nations, showcased their commitment to expanding American commercial interests in the hemisphere.
They also tried to get a naval base in the Caribbean.
Yes, Harrison sent the esteemed Frederick Douglass as ambassador to Haiti. Part of the mission was an unsuccessful attempt to negotiate the lease of Mole Saint-Nicolas for a naval base. Didn't work out, but it demonstrated a clear strategic interest in a Caribbean naval presence, crucial for projecting naval power.
And things were heating up in the Pacific too, right? Yeah. Samoa?
Oh, yeah. In 1889, the U.S., the United Kingdom, and the German Empire were locked in this tense dispute over control of the Samoan Islands. 3 warships from each nation were actually facing off in Apia Harbor before a typhoon hit and damaged them.
Close to conflict.
Very. What's fascinating here is Harrison played a key role in the subsequent Berlin conference determining the status of Samoa. He took a firm stand on every aspect of the negotiations, insisted on the selection of a specific local ruler, refused to allow an indemnity for Germany, and pushed for the establishment of a 3-power protectorate. That was a first for the U.S.
Sharing power, but asserting influence.
Exactly. This arrangement was crucial because it facilitated future U.S. dominance in the Pacific, a significant step in America's emergence as a global player, showing Harrison's willingness to project power even in distant corners of the world.
Harrison's administration also had to deal with international trade wars, didn't it? The pork issue.
Ah, yes, the Great European Pork Embargo. Throughout the 1880s, various European countries, led by Germany, had banned the importation of American pork. The official reason was unconfirmed concerns about trichinosis.
But maybe protectionism was the real motive.
Very likely. This was a huge economic issue for American farmers. Impacted over £1 billion of pork products annually, worth $80 million back then. That's like $2.8 billion today. Harrison vigorously engaged his ministers in France and Germany to get these crucial exports restored without delay.
What tools did he use?
Diplomacy, but also leverage. To counter accusations of product compromise, Harrison persuaded Congress to enact the Meat Inspection Act of 1890, provided federal inspection and certification.
Building trust in the product.
And crucially, he partnered with his agriculture secretary, Jeremiah Rusk, to threaten Germany with retaliation. They initiated a U.S. embargo on Germany's highly demanded beet sugar if the pork ban wasn't lifted.
Playing hardball, tit for tat.
Absolutely. An early example of aggressive trade diplomacy, using economic leverage to protect American industries. And it worked. By September 1891, Germany relented. Denmark, France, Austria-Hungary soon followed suit. A significant diplomatic and economic victory for Harrison's administration. Showed a willingness to fight for American commerce on the international stage.
He faced another crisis over fishing rights, too, this time near Alaska.
Yes, disputed fishing and sealing rights off the coast. Canadian claims regarding rights around many of the Aleutian Islands violated U.S. law, according to the Harrison administration. This led the U.S. Navy, acting as basically a police force, to seize several Canadian sealing ships.
Raising tensions with Britain, presumably? Canada was still part of the empire.
Big time. In 1891, the administration began negotiations with the British, eventually led to a compromise over the rights after international arbitration. The British government ended up paying compensation in 1898. Just goes to show you the sheer range and complexity of international issues he dealt with, often far from the public eye. Boundary disputes, resource conflicts. Sounds familiar, right?
Very. But perhaps the most dramatic international incident of his term was the Chilean-Baltimore crisis of 1891.
Oh, that was a close call. A major diplomatic crisis erupted in Chile, fueled partly by the U.S. minister there, Patrick Egan, granting asylum to Chilean leaders who had lost Chile's civil war.
Taking sides, basically.
Which didn't endear him to the new Chilean government. The crisis escalated dramatically when U.S. sailors from the cruiser USS Baltimore took shore leave in Valparaiso. A brawl broke out, and they were attacked by a Chilean mob. Two American sailors were killed, nearly 20 injured, and 36 arrested.
A serious international incident. How did the U.S. respond?
The ship's captain, Winfield Schley, insisted the Chilean police had actually participated in the attack, even bayoneting sailors without provocation, demanded an apology.
And Harrison.
With Blaine temporarily incapacitated by lumbago again, Harrison personally drafted a strong demand for reparations from Chile.
He took the lead.
Yes. When Chile's foreign minister, Manuel Mata, replied defiantly, calling Harrison's message erroneous or deliberately incorrect, tensions escalated dramatically, pushed the two nations right to the brink of war.
Really? War with Chile?
It was close. Harrison threatened to break off diplomatic relations unless the U.S. received a suitable apology. He forcefully stated, and this shows his resolve, if the dignity as well as the prestige and influence of the United States are not to be wholly sacrificed, we must protect those who in foreign ports display the flag or wear the colors. The Navy was placed on high alert.
So a real showdown.
Ultimately, facing the threat of the modernized U.S. Navy, Chile obliged. They offered an apology and paid reparations. War was averted. Theodore Roosevelt later applauded Harrison for his decisive use of the big stick in this matter.
Interesting. Using PR's famous phrase about Harrison.
Exactly. It perfectly illustrates Harrison's assertive foreign policy, his willingness to use the threat of force. Foreshadows America's growing willingness to project power on the world stage, a truly modern approach to diplomacy, even if risky.
Okay, one more major foreign policy issue right at the end of his term, Hawaii.
Yes, the Hawaiian annexation attempt. In the very last days of his administration, Harrison dealt with this complex issue, following a coup d'etat against Queen Liliuokalani.
Largely engineered by American business interests there.
Indeed. Hawaii's new provisional government, led by Sanford Dole, yes, related to the Pineapple family, quickly petitioned for annexation by the United States. Presented Harrison with a significant decision right as he was heading out the door.
Was he interested?
He was keenly interested in expanding American influence in Hawaii. And specifically, in establishing a naval base at Pearl Harbor, crucial for Pacific power projection, even though he hadn't previously expressed a strong opinion on actually annexing the islands.
So the coup created an opportunity.
It seems so. The U.S. consul in Hawaii recognized the new government on February 1, 1893, forwarded its annexation proposals to Washington. With just a month left before leaving office, Harrison signed a treaty of annexation on February 14th, submitted it to the Senate the very next day with his recommendation.
Cutting it close, did the Senate act?
No. They failed to act before Harrison left office. And President Cleveland, upon taking office shortly after, was suspicious of the coup and promptly withdrew the treaty.
So annexation failed then?
For the time being. But this near annexation reveals Harrison's forward-looking, and some might say imperial, ambitions. Even if unfulfilled during his term, it set the stage for future American expansion and geopolitical maneuvering in the Pacific, another sign of him pointing towards a more global American role.
Beyond foreign policy and the Navy, Harrison also left his mark on the judiciary and the very map of the country, didn't he?
Absolutely. He appointed four justices to the Supreme Court, David Josiah Brewer, Henry Billings Brown, George Shiras, and Howell Edmonds Jackson.
Four appointments is significant.
It is. And he even strategically selected Jackson, a respected Tennessee Democrat, at the very end of his term. He knew the incoming Senate would be controlled by Democrats, so picking a Democrat increased the chances his nominee wouldn't be rejected.
Clever political move to secure a lasting impact on the federal bench.
What's key here isn't just the number, but that Harrison, through these four additions, subtly steered the court towards a more business-friendly, yet constitutionally grounded interpretation of federal power, setting the stage for future corporate regulation debates.
And the map.
Perhaps one of the most tangible, enduring legacies of his administration was the admission of 6 new states to the Union.
6. That's a lot.
More than any other president. North Dakota, South Dakota, Montana, and Washington all came in November 1889, followed by Idaho in July 1890, and Wyoming also in July 1890.
Wow, reshaping the West.
Fundamentally reshaping the map of the United States, ushering in a new era of Western expansion and influence, bringing those territories fully into the nation. This truly highlights his impact on the physical and political landscape of the country. #7, the exit and enduring legacy.
So after all that activity, the economic legislation, the foreign policy assertiveness, adding states, you'd think Harrison would be set for re-election in 1892. But the conditions weren't great, were they?
Far from ideal. That treasury surplus, which had been a political issue itself, had evaporated, and the nation's economic health was noticeably worsening. Clear precursors to the big panic of 1893 that would hit soon after he left office.
Bad timing.
Very. The congressional elections in 1890 had already gone against the Republicans, a sign of public dissatisfaction. And Harrison faced growing discontent within his own party.
Those alienated party bosses again.
Yep. Still frustrated by his adamant refusal to grant patronage appointments the way they wanted. They quietly organized what they actually called a grievance committee to initiate a dump Harrison offensive.
Trying to deny him renomination?
It was clear he wouldn't be renominated unanimously, a significant challenge for an incumbent president. Even though Blaine announced he wasn't a candidate back in February 92, some party leaders still hoped to draft him, especially after Blaine dramatically resigned as Secretary of State in June, just weeks before the convention.
Adding to the drama.
Despite this significant opposition, the internal party maneuvering, Harrison ultimately prevailed. Won renomination on the first ballot to the Minneapolis convention, but it was a hard-fought victory that really showed a fractured, unhappy party.
And who did the Democrats nominate?
Grover Cleveland, of course, setting up a rematch of the 1888 election.
Harrison versus Cleveland, part two.
And the political winds had shifted. That high McKinley tariff, which had made imported goods expensive for average Americans, had pushed many voters towards the Democrats' reform position, favoring lower tariffs.
Pocketbook issues.
Always powerful. Plus, many traditional Republican voters out west defected to the new populist party candidate, James Weaver.
The populist surge.
Weaver promised free silver, generous veterans' pensions, an eight-hour workday, pulling votes Harrison needed. And the violent suppression of the homestead strike that summer, though the federal government didn't directly intervene, also negatively impacted the Republicans in the eyes of labor voters, tarnished their image.
A lot of factors working against him.
And then adding immense personal tragedy to the political challenges.
Yeah.
Harrison's wife, Caroline, had been battling tuberculosis.
His wife, Carrie, who he met back in college.
That's right. She tragically died just 2 weeks before the election on October 25th.
Oh, that's devastating. Right before the vote.
A profound personal loss. This, coupled with the fact that both candidates had already served in the White House, led to a remarkably low-key campaign in the final weeks. Neither candidate actively campaigned personally out of respect, a somber end to a hard-fought political chapter.
What was the result?
A decisive defeat for Harrison. Cleveland won the election pretty easily. 277 electoral votes to Harrison's 145 secured a clear popular vote victory, too, over 380,000 votes.
A clear mandate for Cleveland.
It was the most decisive presidential election in 20 years. Marked a clear rejection of the Republican platform and perhaps Harrison's more aloof leadership style. He became the first president to be succeeded in office by his immediate predecessor.
Wow, that's rare. Cleveland served non-consecutive terms.
Exactly. Highlights the turbulent transitional nature of the era, back and forth between the parties.
So Harrison leaves office. What does he do next? Go back to Indianapolis.
Yes. After leaving office, he returned to his private life and law practice in Indianapolis. He made appearances, gave lectures, even did a stint at teaching constitutional law at Stanford University in 1894. Lived out in San Francisco for a few months.
Kept busy. Did he try for a comeback?
Some friends of the Republican Party tried to convince him to seek the presidency again in 96, but he declined. Instead, he campaigned for William McKinley, remaining an influential voice in the party, just from a different platform, elder statesman role.
And he had that big international law case, right?
Yes. In 1898, he gained significant international renown, served as the lead attorney for Venezuela in its boundary dispute with Great Britain over the border with British Guiana.
Taking on the British Empire in court.
He filed an impressive 800-page brief, spent over 25 hours arguing Venezuela's case in court in Paris. Though Venezuela ultimately lost the case on most points, his legal arguments garnered him huge international respect, showed his sharp legal mind was still very much active.
Still engaged on the world stage.
He also attended the first peace conference at The Hague in 1899, continued his engagement with global affairs, international law, diplomacy, even after his presidency. showcased a mind consistently dedicated to those principles.
Now, Harrison was often described then and now as a conservative, nicknamed the conservative president. Herbert Hoover even apparently called Calvin Coolidge a real conservative, probably the equal of Benjamin Harrison. High praise from that wing.
True, that label stuck. But it's crucial to understand, as we've seen, that Harrison was not simply an advocate of laissez-faire, the idea that government should just leave the economy alone.
Right. Sherman Act, pensions, inspections, that's not hands-off.
Not at all. He firmly believed and said that the national government has a duty to provide work, employment, comfort to the American working man. Argued this responsibility went beyond just local government.
A federal responsibility for worker welfare?
Yes. He also passionately spoke about workers earning a living wage. And get this, he advocated for a Social Security fund, his words, to provide coverage for old age, accidents, and sickness.
Wow. That's incredibly progressive for the 1890s, decades ahead of the New Deal.
Absolutely. Demonstrating a surprisingly progressive vision for social welfare that was far ahead of his time. It really challenges that simple conservative label and speaks to his nuanced, maybe evolving approach to federal power and social responsibility.
And speaking of evolving views, his stance on imperialism changed too, didn't it?
It did. Though he had supported the annexation of Hawaii during his presidency, Harrison later grew to oppose further imperialism under President McKinley, particularly after the Spanish-American War.
What prompted that shift?
He was disturbed by the idea of ruling territories like Puerto Rico without granting them full constitutional rights. In response to tariffs being imposed on Puerto Rico, despite it being part of the U.S., he declared, and this is powerful, a government of unlimited and absolute executive power is not an American government. If the act of annexation does not carry the Constitution, I can think of nothing else that does.
Applying constitutional principles universally.
This is a profound statement. Showcasing a president whose views continued to evolve, who kept thinking critically about the fundamental principles of American governance and its role in the world, especially as the nation grappled with new imperial ambitions. He was pushing for a constitutionalist view, even when it contradicted the political currents of the time. Really crystallizes his commitment to bedrock American principles.
So how did his life end?
Benjamin Harrison died on March 13, 1901, at the age of 67. Complications from influenza that turned into pneumonia. His last reported words were poignant, asking about his doctors. Are the doctors here? Doctor, my lungs.
A quiet end for a sometimes quiet president. He was buried in Indianapolis's Crown Hill Cemetery next to his first wife, Caroline, leaving behind this legacy that was, for a long time, really underestimated.
For sure. While scholars have generally ranked him as average, often, as we said, due to a lack of eventful major wars or maybe a lack of personal charisma, recent historical analysis, particularly by Charles Calhoun, fundamentally challenges this. Calhoun gives Harrison major credit for that innovative legislation, antitrust, monetary policy, tariffs. Argues Harrison was actually even more responsible than Secretary Blaine for the success of trade negotiations, that crucial steel navy buildup, and America's overseas expansion, emphasizing the Monroe Doctrine. And throughout his career, Harrison maintained a widespread reputation for personal and official integrity. Even his critics usually admitted that.
So a reassessment is underway.
I think so. His economic policies, controversial as they were, sometimes contributing to instability, were undeniably significant. His robust support for African-American voting rights and education, those are the last major attempts to protect civil rights through federal means until the 1930s. His tenacity in foreign policy was clearly emulated by figures like Theodore Roosevelt. Harrison's presidency, though squarely in the 19th century, really clearly pointed the way to the modern presidency that emerged under William McKinley and T.R.
And his legacy is still visible, right? Memorials, place names.
Oh yeah, far from forgotten. Honored on 6 U.S. postage stamps, featured on $5 national banknotes back in the day, a presidential $1 coin more recently. There's the Benjamin Harrison Memorial Statue in Indianapolis. His home there is now a library and museum. Fort Benjamin Harrison in Indiana. Halls named after him at Miami University and Purdue. His impact is still felt, even if not always widely recognized or fully understood.
So after digging deep, what does this all mean for Benjamin Harrison? We've seen a man of, well, deep conviction,
sure,
a decorated Civil War general who famously led his troops with a simple, come on, boys.
Yeah.
A senator who pushed for civil rights, even when it was unpopular, even within his own party. And a president who signed truly groundbreaking legislation like the Sherman Antitrust Act, created the nation's first national forest reserves. aggressively modernized the Navy and American foreign policy.
He tackled some of the most complex issues of his time, didn't he? Tariffs, currency, the very definition of civil rights, often with a quiet determination that maybe belied his profound impact.
He was a president who, despite often being called average, oversaw more states admitted to the Union than any other, initiated America's rise as a legitimate global naval power, even made the first presidential voice recording.
Yeah. And his earnest, almost academic approach to governance, it often alienated the political machine, right? The party bosses who expected patronage. But maybe it also allowed him to pursue policy with a clearer sense of duty and principle, prioritizing long-term vision over short-term political gain sometimes.
His impact feels foundational, a true bridge to the 20th century.
I think that's right.
So this deep dive into Benjamin Harrison really asks us, and asks you, to reconsider what average truly means in the context of leadership. Is it all about charisma, grand gestures, the sheer volume of immediate celebrated legislation?
Or is it sometimes about the quiet, consistent work, building institutions, expanding federal power carefully to protect rights, the environment, workers, setting the course for the future, even if those efforts aren't immediately met with public acclaim or even fully successful right away?
Harrison's impact was often subtle, foundational, perhaps all the more enduring for it, shaping America in ways we're still grappling with today. So what will you look for when you next evaluate a leader's legacy? The loudest voice and maybe the quiet modernizer.